Is that enough?
Good morning, or no, good afternoon. This meeting of the Energy Policy Committee will come to order. Looks like we have a quorum. Eventually we'll have more of both kinds of members in the room, but we might as well get started. This is an introductory hearing. For the month of January, we will be doing some overviews. I don't expect we'll start hearing bills until in the first week of February. In the area of energy, there's a lot to learn. And so I thought it made the most sense if we all got a grounding in the information we need to learn to make good policy in the area of energy. And so what I thought we'd do today is start with brief introductions from members, and then we have Bob Eliff from House Research to go over some of the significant laws that are in place and the legislative history behind getting those laws in place. And then we have an overview from the Department of Commerce. And I'm not sure if they have coordinated ahead of time and they each know how much time they want. But what we'll do when we get to the presentations is we will let our speakers go all the way through their presentation, and then we'll ask questions at the end. If there's something that you don't hear and you have sort of an immediate clarifying question, members, that you would like to ask, feel free. But we'll wait for more detailed questions and sort of the beginnings of policy discussions until the speakers have had time to get all the way through their presentation. So I thought it would be good for us to get to know each other just a little bit. And so we'll go around and do introductions. And why don't we start at the very end with Representative Quam and just tell us the district number that you represent, obviously your name, and a little bit about your area, the cities that are in it or something about the geographic area you represent.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dwayne Quam, District 25A, parts of Dodge and Olmsted County. I have the city of Rochester, and then the rest of my district is made up of small towns, rural areas, farms, and so it's, you know, the third largest city and a bunch of small ones.
Representative Tom Hackbarth, I represent Northern Anoka County. It's 31B. The city is of partially the city of Oak Grove and part of Andover, all of the city of East Bethel, Ham Lake, Columbus, and Linwood.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair. State Representative Frank Hornstein, District 61A, which is parts of downtown Minneapolis and parts of southwest Minneapolis.
Hello, Representative Tim Kelly from 21A. It encompasses towns of Cannon Falls down to Wabasha, which includes Red Wing, right down the Mississippi River Valley, one of the most beautiful spots in the state. One of the reasons I'm asked to be sitting here is we have the Prairie Island Nuclear Power Plant sitting in our district as well. So looking forward to it.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. State Representative Andrew Falk, District 17A, Western Minnesota, encompasses all of Swift, Chippewa, most of Renville, and part of Candy White counties. And this will be starting my fifth year serving on the Energy Committee, so thankful to be here.
Madam Chair, Will Morgan. I represent parts of Burnsville and Lakeville in Dakota County. My constituents are customers of XL Energy and Dakota Electric Association. So I look forward to seeing what we can do to help them. Thank you.
Somebody did their homework.
Mary Faust, Committee Legislative Assistant.
I'm Representative Melissa Hortman. I represent Brooklyn Park and Coon Rapids, so I have a portion of Hennepin County and a portion of Anoka County, and I have Conexus customers and XL customers.
Peter Stromer, I'll be the committee
administrator. Bob Eliff with House Research.
Well, first of all, since no one's done it yet, congratulations, Madam Chair, on your appointment to chair of the committee.
Thank you.
Pat Groflow, I'm serving in my fifth term. I represent Farmington as well as portions of rural Dakota and Goodhue counties.
Madam Chair, I'm Mike Beard. I'm the state representative from Shakopee, Jackson, Louisville Township, now known as District 55A. I'm privileged to start my sixth term. All six terms I've been able to sit on this committee, one of my favorite committees. The city I represent, Shakopee, is split between XL Energy, Minnesota Valley Electric, and Shakopee Public Utilities. So I have distribution, retail sales in each of the camps, co-ops, munis, and investor-owned. Minnegasco also services our area. We also have two generating facilities, the Blue Lake Peaking Plant, about a mile south of my house, and the Coda Energy Biomass Plant, perhaps we can take a tour of that one of these days.
Great. Madam Chair, my name is Yvonne Seltzer, and I represent 48A, which is Southern Minnetonka and Northern Eden Prairie.
Madam Chair, I'm Sandra Mason. I represent 51A, which is Western Eagan and Northern Burnsville. And the main utilities would be Dakota Electric, which is a co-op, and XL Energy.
Madam Chair, I'm Representative Barbara Russo. I represent District 42A, which includes Arden Hills, Moundsview, and parts of Shoreview and Spring Lake Park.
I'm Susan Allen, and I represent South Minneapolis, District 62B, which is south of Lake Street.
Thank you. I'm going to mention two things about the materials that are in your folder. There's a draft of committee procedures. I think, members, you've probably seen the emails going around from other committees with their procedures, and we thought we would get your feedback on the proposed procedures. They're not really rules, except for the 24-hour one, what I would consider sort of a rule.
Madam Chair, will all committee procedures be printed on the back of Steve Smith's letterhead?
And that is the second item I wanted to bring to members' attention. When you get your order form to order your stationery, I just want you to know I think I have enough leftover letterhead from previous members to make it through the next 17 years of all paper needs that I would have in my personal and professional life. So we'll be trying to reuse some of the materials that are around the state office building, and we don't believe in wasting materials, so if you want to keep something, put it in your save folder, and we will save it. If you leave it out, we will recycle it, but we'd prefer not to make copies of color documents twice if you're planning to use them again, so please use your save folder. And with that, I think I will turn it over to Bob to give us a little bit of education.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, we're going to be hearing later today from the Department of Commerce and also in later hearings from the Public Utilities Commission and the Pollution Control Agency and other agencies that participate in the regulation of energy here in Minnesota. I thought what might be most useful for me to do today, especially in light of the fact that we have many new members on the committee that have not served on the committee before, is to give a larger framework for on which to hang the information that we're going to hear from the agencies later on. Talk more about the context in which regulation occurs here at the state level in Minnesota, and in doing that, review some of the past legislative efforts that frame Minnesota's energy system. Representative Beard mentioned IOUs. That's the first acronym I think we're going to hear, we heard so far in this committee, but let me talk a little bit about what those are. It stands for investor-owned utilities, and there are five of them in Minnesota, including Xcel, Minnesota Power, Outer Terra Power, and others. And they account for about 65% of the electricity sales in Minnesota. Someone else mentioned co-ops. There are rural co-ops, mostly owned and governed by their members under Minnesota law. Most of them are distribution co-ops, which means they have retail customers to whom they distribute their energy. There are also generation and transmission co-ops in Minnesota, half a dozen of them, that actually generate their own power, transmit it to their member cooperatives who then transmit it to retail customers. And they represent about 21% of the electricity sales in Minnesota. Finally, there are municipal utilities that are run by city councils or local public utility commissions. There are 131 electric municipals in Minnesota and 30 gas municipals, and they account for about 14% of state sales. Akin to those G&T co-ops, there are municipal power authorities that again provide kind of a wholesale function by generating power and sending it to member cooperatives. Generation and transmission. Thank you. Only the investor-owned utilities are price-regulated in Minnesota. The others are, as the statutes tell us, presently effectively regulated, so don't need to be regulated by price in Minnesota. Cooperatives may elect to be price-regulated, but so far only one has done so. But don't think that the co-ops and munis, as we refer to them in shorthands, are not regulated by the PUC at all, because other aspects, non-price aspects of their operations certainly are. For example, the generation and transmission co-ops and the municipal power authorities are subject to the state's renewable energy standard, which requires a certain percentage of their retail sales to be generated from renewable resources on certain dates.
Hey, Bob, can we have you pull your microphone just a little closer?
I certainly can.
Thank you.
Thank you. Co-ops and munis are also required to participate in the state's conservation improvement program, which requires utilities to invest their revenues to improve customer energy efficiency. And again, both co-ops and municipal utilities are subject to the state's cold weather rule, which prevents utilities from disconnecting residential heating customers at certain times of the year under certain conditions if they're on a payment plan, although co-ops and munis act under slightly different regulations than IOUs under that program. But only IOUs are price regulated. And I guess the question arises, why is that the case? And largely, it reflects the economic conditions under which those companies operate, by which I mean the capital intensity of the energy industry. You can imagine the cost of generation plants, high voltage transmission lines going to all customers. That high capital intensity and basically means we've set aside exclusive service areas for cooperatives. There's no competition for customers. Each utility has a certain geographical area in which it and it alone provides service. And the reason for that is if there were competition, we'd have pipelines and service lines going all over the place in search of more customers, and that would be very inefficient from the point of all customers as a whole, because it would increase the cost tremendously. So exclusive service territories prevent this, but they also remove the cost minimizing forces of competition, and it's price regulation by the Public Utilities Commission that is supposed to substitute for that competition. And what the commission is, the goal the commission is seeking is, as it's stated in statute, just and reasonable prices and non-discriminatory prices. But although the PUC regulates retail costs, it doesn't regulate other kinds of costs, which are wholesale costs, which are regulated by the federal government. The cost of fuel itself, natural gas and coal, are passed through to retail customers. I might also mention the federal government also regulates the transmission of energy across state lines. But here in Minnesota, the commission focuses on regulating the retail costs. Since it doesn't regulate the fuel costs, what the PUC does regulate is the physical equipment a utility uses to transform the fuel into useful energy and to distribute it to its customers here in Minnesota. Generation plants, distribution pipelines, wires, pollution control equipment, all of that equipment is in what is called the utility's rate base. And it's the rate base on which the utility is allowed to earn a rate of return, which is also determined by the PUC in a procedure called a rate case. And you may have read that Xcel Energy is currently undergoing a rate case at the Public Utilities Commission. And what that is a very formal trial-like procedure, which can last 9 months to a year, under which all the costs of the utility are examined by an administrative law judge from the Office of Administrative Hearings in Minnesota. There is testimony filed, written testimony. There is cross-examination of all witnesses on that testimony by lawyers for all the parties that have intervened in the case. And at the end of the first part of the procedure, the administrative law judge, who has overseen all that part of a case, writes up a list of findings and conclusions and sends those to the Public Utilities Commission, which considers them, can make changes, and it's the PUC which eventually issues an order stating how much rates can go up, in what areas, all those kinds of decisions. It's a very long and very detailed process. There are other regulatory procedures that help the commission to decide what goes into a rate base. If a utility decides that it's it needs to build a new power plant, for example, it has to obtain what's called a certificate of need from the commission. Again, the same kind of trial-like process occurs, this time examining the need for whatever piece of equipment or high-voltage transmission line the utility is seeking to have. There are also long-term plans so that the commission knows kind of what may be coming. There's what's called an integrated resource plan, and it's a 15-year forecast of both the demand for energy in the utility service area and an outline of how the utility proposes to meet that demand. Again, this is something that PUC must approve. There are also transmission plans that utilities that operate transmission lines are required to file periodically with the commission to find out the inadequacies in those lines and what plans are being made to deal with those inadequacies. Again, the commission must approve all transmission plans. Obviously, utilities want to recover costs in a timely fashion, and rate cases, because they are so long, involved, and expensive, only occur or usually occur at the interval of several years. So utilities have sought, and in many cases the legislature has often approved, a quicker cost recovery without having to file a rate case. The company still needs PUC approval to begin charging customers for these costs, but it's done in a different kind of a procedure. And we've done that a number of times here at the legislature, and the statutes are full of instances where that has occurred. For example, if a county is building a road and as a result the natural gas pipelines have to be moved, the cost of moving that infrastructure can be recovered more quickly by the utility. They don't have to go through a rate case to recover those costs. On the electric side, replacing electric infrastructure that saves energy or that uses it more efficiently can similarly be approved by the PUC outside of a rate case. In 2006, Minnesota passed a law greatly reducing mercury emissions from a handful of power plants in the state. Again, those costs can be handled by the Utility Commission outside of a rate case. Similarly, a number of years ago, Xcel Energy had something called the Metro Emissions Reduction Plan, which replaced coal burning facilities at two of its plants with natural gas burning facilities, and also included new air pollution controls on one of its plants. Those costs similarly went through a non-rate case process examined by the commission. If you look at the statutes that have been passed over the past 10 or 15 years, you'll notice a lot of them are dealing with conservation and renewable energies, and I'd like to turn my attention to those for a few minutes now. Utilities have been required to make conservation investments since 1991, but they're not required to make any conservation investment that is not cost effective. The way the system was set up, utilities had to essentially meet a spending goal. A certain percentage of their gross operating revenues had to be devoted to conservation, I believe 0.5% for gas and 1.5% for electricity. In 2007, the legislature replaced the spending goal with a performance goal, saying giving utilities the goal of saving 1.5% of their gross retail electric sales, and it was up to the utilities how best to spend that money or how efficiently to spend that money to achieve those goals. Whereas the spending goals saved on average about 0.8% of electricity and 0.3% of gas sales each year, by 2010, 3 years after the performance goal was passed, spending had increased. In fact, it had more than doubled in electricity, and the savings had also increased by about 90%. Almost 900 million kilowatt hours were saved as a result. And the Department of Commerce also calculated that the total benefits to the utilities by avoiding costs of purchasing fuels and delivering them, minus the cost of administering the Conservation Improvement Program itself, increased under the performance goal rather than the spending goal, increased by over $100 million in 2010 over 2007. Also in 2007, the legislature required utilities to spend a certain percentage of their gross operating revenues, 0.2%, on low-income programs to help people pay their bills more frequently. And one other measure, again in 2007, that was passed by the legislature were the Sustainable Building 2030 guidelines, which we contract with the University of Minnesota to develop energy performance standards for new commercial, industrial, and institutional buildings in order to reduce energy use. And the savings goals for those guidelines were compared with an average building energy use in 2003 to save 60% in 2010, 70% in 2015, and 90% in 2025. Turning for a moment to renewable energy, it's interesting and maybe ironic that I think the biggest boost to renewable energy in the state was the result of the failure of the federal government. In this case, the failure was to construct a permanent facility for the storage of nuclear waste, which the Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982 required the federal government to do in 1998. Because it was expected that nuclear fuel would be reprocessed, as it had been done throughout the 1950s, or put in this permanent facility, plants themselves did not have, when they were built in the 1970s, as were Minnesota's, did not build accompanying storage capacity. Any storage that occurred was occurring in the spent fuel pools in the reactors themselves. But reading the handwriting on the wall, in 1989, Xcel applied to the Public Utilities Commission for a certificate of need to actually build a storage facility on site at its Prairie Island facility. And an administrative law judge, under the certificate of need process, found that the facility was permanent storage and therefore required legislative approval under a 1977 law. The commission disagreed with that assessment and said the storage was temporary. It granted a certificate of need and authorized the construction of 17 casks to hold nuclear waste. And that decision of the PUC was appealed to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, which supported the PUC's approval of the certificate of need, but also said that the storage is, quote, more likely than not, unquote, permanent, and therefore legislative approval was needed. I don't know if anybody here sat through those hearings in 1994. I wasn't here either, but my understanding is it was kind of a knockdown, drag-out fight that eventually resulted in a compromise, authorization for 17 casks at Prairie Island. But in return, the concern was that alternative forms of energy be pursued. Xcel Energy was given a mandate to develop 825 megawatts of wind by 2002 and 125 megawatts of biomass by the same date. The act also established the renewable development account, to which the company was to contribute, beginning in 1999, $500,000 a year for each cask stored at Prairie Island, and that money was to be used for the development of renewable energy sources. As Xcel was reaching the end date for those wind and biomass mandates, the concept was broadened to include both more technologies and more utilities. In 2001, Minnesota established a renewable energy objective, which required IOUs, municipal power authorities, generation and transmission co-ops, to in 2001, the law was passed and said by 2005, 1% of retail electric energy sales of those utilities should be coming from renewable sources of energy. And in 2015, the goal was 10%. Utilities were to make, quote, a good faith effort to do that, although Xcel itself was mandated to reach those goals. In 2007, that good faith effort was dispensed with, and the idea of mandating utilities to reach those goals was put into statute. And the Renewable Energy Standard, as it's now called, requires 25% of retail electricity to by the year 2025, 30% for Xcel. In that law were included what are usually referred to as off-ramps, allowing the Public Utilities Commission to modify or delay implementation of that standard if they find it to be in the public interest, i.e. if there's significant rate impacts, if there are reliability problems with the electric system as a result, technical problems, delays in receiving equipment, or transmission constraints. So far, those off-ramps have not been implemented. And in 2010, the legislature passed a statute requiring that utilities report the impact of the cost impact of complying with renewable energy standard on utility bills. I mentioned the Renewable Development Fund, which also came out of the 1994 Prairie Island Act. That began, Xcel began contributing $500,000 per cask in 1999. In 2003, that situation was changed to a flat $16 million a year in exchange for additional casks at Prairie Island. Through today, I think more than $200 million has been contributed to that fund. And one of the uses of that fund was to fund the Renewable Energy Production Incentive, which initially supported 100 megawatts of wind. Essentially, this would give developers of wind projects 1.5 cents for each kilowatt hour generated for a period of 10 years, giving them a long-term revenue stream to make initial financing of the project easier. The cap was set at 200 megawatts, which was soon filled up, and that has continued that program has continued to operate, funded by the Renewable Development Fund. Spending peaked at just under $10 million in 2011. This year it will decline to about $8 million and to $2.2 million in 2018 as that 10-year period winds down for all of those projects. In 2010, we reestablished the fee at $500,000 per cask at Prairie Island. It's $350,000 for the storage site at Monticello, which has smaller casks. And right now it's bringing in about $24.5 million a year. And it costs the average Xcel residential ratepayer about $7 per year. The bulk of that money has been used for research grants for renewable energy around the state. There's a board set up that reviews proposals, grant proposals, and those recommendations from that board go to the Public Utilities Commission for final approval. The legislature has also made additional appropriations from that Renewable Development Fund for renewable energies. The 10-year period, about $30 million has gone to the Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment at the University of Minnesota. About $10 million went to the Mesaba Coal Gasification Plant project in northern Minnesota. And starting in 2010 and extending to 2015, about $21 million has been allocated as a rebate for Minnesota-made solar collectors installed in the state. I just want to mention a couple of current issues that will be affecting whatever we do here, certainly for this year and probably years to come. One is the reduced growth we've seen in electricity growth. Xcel Energy's most recent IRP has pegged the growth for the next 15 years at 0.5% per year, which in 2010 they were projecting 0.9% a year, so it was cut almost in half. That's for a projection for the next 15 years. And Xcel has estimated that because that growth is slow, it will not need additional generation resource until about 2018, and it expects to add about 400 to 600 megawatts of natural gas in 2017 to 2019. That's a second trend that has been happening quite a bit, not only Minnesota but nationally, the increased use of gas to generate electricity. Across the country, more than 80% of the capacity additions in 2000 to 2010 decade was natural gas. And it's happened in Minnesota as well. Natural gas deliveries for electric power generation in 2000 was about 10 billion cubic feet of gas. By 2007, it was 35 billion cubic feet. The reasons are pretty simple, really. New technology, natural gas combustion turbines used through the 80s and 90s were used mostly as peaking plants, but a new combined cycle technology, which basically uses waste heat to generate additional electricity, came into effect, making these plants highly efficient. They're quicker to build. They can be built in a period of 2 or 3 years, and they cost about half the cost per kilowatt installed as a coal plant. They can also be built at a small scale, about 100 megawatts, and are modular in construction, so you can build as many of them as you needed. Anyway, the point I'm making is there's a lot more natural gas that's generating electricity in Minnesota than there used to be, and given the low price of natural gas we see now, that's expected to continue. The last issue I just wanted to mention in terms of what's out there that's impacting Minnesota are some federal environmental controls. The mercury and air toxic standards for new and existing power plants were recently enacted by EPA that set numerical limits for mercury, because power plants are the largest U.S. source of mercury right now. About 50% of the mercury across the country is from power plants. It also sets numerical limits for particulate matter and for acid gases. Facilities will have 4 years to comply with these new rules, and the control and technologies that they need to use for that exist. About 1,100 coal-fired units across the country will be affected, including many of those in Minnesota. And we've already heard that some plants are considering whether or not to shut down early as a result of these new standards, because it would be more expensive to retrofit the plant to meet the standards than makes sense. Rochester Public Utility is shutting down its Silver Lake plant in 2015. The Austin Municipal Utility is switching its plant over to natural gas. The Hoot Lake plant from Minnesota Power is certainly considering what it might want to do. And the Black Dog plants in Xcel are also looking at either switching to natural gas or possibly shutting down entirely. About 12,000 megawatts in the 13-state area that can that makes up what's called the Midwest Independent System Operator, to which Minnesota belongs, are going to be affected by this rule, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. One of the most interesting things is that while it makes sense for individual plants to switch to natural gas, they can't all do that, because analysis has been done to show that we just don't have the transmission capacity in the Midwest to enable that to happen. So it's going to be very interesting to watch how utilities will be coping with these new federal rules. Madam Chair, that ends my talk.
Thank you, Mr. Ila. It's going to be hard for me to switch from casual interim speak, where I refer to Representative Garofalo as Pat, but I will try to formalize my communications. If I call you by your first name in this committee, I'm sorry, and please correct me. Representative Beard had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Ila, when you were talking about the Integrated Resource Plan, the IRP, and Madam Chair, if I just tell the new folks on the committee, there's a lot of acronyms go flying around here, but after, I don't know, 6 months, couple years, you'll have them all down pat. One thing that we may just ask Mr. Elif to do, Madam Chair, a suggestion that I've seen work in the past, is a cheat sheet with the acronyms and a quick description that we can put in that save folder. It would be pretty cool. But I actually have a question about the IRP that may be for the good of the committee. Every 5 years, they have to update this 15-year plan for their generation and their transmission needs. But do they have to give an accounting for how their depreciations go on, how the wear and tear on the infrastructure that's already in place is? For instance, I know some of the rate cases are coming up are for replacement for depreciation, towers and lines, utility poles that are worn out or at the end of their useful life, so on and so forth. The gas companies have pipelines that actually wear out. When they do their IRPs, do they have to account for the state of their physical plant and what they're anticipating for replacement for depreciation?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, that's an excellent question.
Is that a PUC question, Mr. Elof?
I wouldn't mind bumping it to them. it is an excellent question, though, and I've looked into it, and a lot of our plant is very, very old out there, and we need to think about replacing it, and it has to be addressed.
Any other questions for Mr. Ila? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just request, there's a great deal of information there, especially with so many new people to energy. Can we have an electronic copy of the sheet you're reading off of?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Great suggestion. Okay. If we don't have any other questions, then we will move on to. Do we have any other questions? We will move on to the Department of Commerce. I see they have a PowerPoint. Color. That's nice. I always love when I go to testify at a committee and somebody asks me, "Do you have a PowerPoint, representative?" Generally speaking, representatives, we never have PowerPoints. But welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you work for.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Bill Grant for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And you'd be welcome to use my first name if you'd like, Madam Chair. Building on Bob's excellent, Mr. Eliff's excellent presentation to the committee this afternoon, I thought what I would do is try and give you an overview of those activities the Department of Commerce carries out in this larger regulatory and energy policy world that we that you're suddenly all living in. The Division of Energy Resources within the Department of Commerce, and let me see if I can figure out how to move the... Oh, there we go. Carries out a number of activities, both regulatory and non-regulatory. On the regulatory side, one of the things we do is to advocate on behalf of the public interest in regulated utility matters. And so we are the agency with the analytical staff that reviews all matters that come before the Public Utilities Commission, be it a rate case, be it an integrated resource plan, be it a request for a certificate of need. And we advocate a position in front of the commission that reflects our view of the public's interest in those matters. This is different than how most states operate, because in most states, the advocacy and analysis staff are housed in the Public Utilities Commission. Usually be what's called a Chinese wall between the staff that does the advocacy and analysis and those staff that compile the record before the Public Utilities Commission makes a decision. In Minnesota, for reasons that we can go into that are of some vintage now, we've separated those functions. And again, our function is to advocate on ratepayers' behalf in all matters that come before the commission. On the non-regulatory side, one of our activities is to assist low-income Minnesotans with heating assistance and weatherization service. So we're the agency to whom federal funds come for the low-income home energy assistance program. Serves about 150,000 Minnesotans annually with heating assistance and crisis assistance to help them maintain electric and natural gas or other heating service within their homes, and weatherization services to help improve the quality of the buildings that they're living in, their homes, to help defray energy costs on a going forward basis. Another non-regulatory function is to help new energy technologies with market entry. There are any number of entrepreneurs in Minnesota who are anxious to develop new energy technologies of one kind or another. We provide assistance to those entities with information, sometimes with grant dollars. Usually those have come in the form of federal grant dollars. The stimulus funds were one good example of that. There are occasionally block grant funds that also come to the state, and we're able to help entrepreneurs with gaining a foothold in the market with good new energy technologies. We oversee the Utility Conservation Improvement Program, and Mr. Eliff referenced this. This is the program that requires utilities to make investments on behalf of their customers to reduce their energy use now by 1.5% annually. And Mr. Eliff mentioned Xcel's current rate of growth at something less than 0.5% per year. I think it's instructive to realize that without the Conservation Improvement Program, that growth rate would be more like 2% per year, and we would be seeing much more in the way of proposals for construction of new facilities to meet those new energy needs if it weren't for the fact that we were making significant investments in energy conservation programs on behalf of consumers. Oh boy, that was a mistake.
Well, you get some technical assistance. We have a member of the administration joining us for the hearing. The commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Mike Rothman, is here. I don't know if he's going to join Bill in delivering the presentation or if he's here just to provide moral support.
Madam Chair, just a quick question.
Representative Garofalo.
I'm just wondering, to the testifier, did the computer stop working because the wind stopped blowing? Or what happened there?
Energy Committee jokes, funny.
It's entirely possible.
Commissioner Rothman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to beg your indulgence, too. We just had our overview at the Senate Commerce Committee, so I raced over here. But I knew ably that, with or without me, that Deputy Commissioner Grant could take care of all of this stuff. And most importantly, I just want to, off the top, say, you know, it's good to see everybody. Thank you for, you know, the work that we've done in the past. At the same time, our staff, as you know, are unbelievable resources for information, both policy-wise, but in technical details and all of that, so that we're available and happy to work with everybody on policy and everything that you need. And then, as you'll see, the department has a broad swath of regulatory responsibility and programs within its jurisdiction. And, you know, since I started, I've learned energy. And at the same time, I know that all the years that Bill Grant has been in the energy area and the experience that he has just been, for me, a phenomenal resource to partner with him in terms of bringing the expertise needed for Minnesota's public policy on energy. So with that, I don't want to take the committee more time. I just want to thank you for being here. And I know Bill's going to do a wonderful job. So
I've seen
the presentation.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. We tried to coordinate with the Senate a little bit, and tomorrow we'll have a shared hearing for the PUC, but unfortunately Mr. Grant gets to do his presentation more than once.
Well, I'm just going to take a back seat.
I'm still not sure. Thank you, Commissioner. I'm still not sure how these slides advance. And yeah, last couple of slides. Oh, this is down here. One more. Yep, so, okay, very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry for the technical difficulties. I wanted just to jump back for a second on the Conservation Improvement Program and point out that unlike most everything else of a regulatory nature, it is actually the department that reviews and approves Conservation Improvement Program plans submitted by utilities. And so this is one difference in function and role that between the department and the Public Utilities Commission. Of course, all of those Conservation Improvement Program plans kind of roll up into our part and very much a part of the integrated resource plans that utilities also submit and that are first reviewed by our staff but ultimately acted upon by the Public Utilities Commission. Works when you do it. There we go. Back to the regulatory front, another area that we work on is to assist the Public Utilities Commission with siting and permitting of large energy facilities. It's our staff that performs the environmental review function when utilities propose new large energy facilities, and this could include new large power plants, large transmission lines, large wind turbine projects. So it's our staff that performs the environmental review. That then rolls up to the Public Utilities Commission for a decision about whether or not to grant a site and route permit for a particular facility. We distribute information to Minnesotans about their individual energy use and actions that they can take to reduce that usage. This is one of the oldest functions of the what used to be the Minnesota Energy Agency and has been along with department functions ever since. We prepare public information for consumers about their energy use, everything ranging from ice dams to how to seal their attic bypasses properly and so forth. A wide range of information. We distribute that upon request, but we also do a significant amount of outreach. You probably have run into us at the state fair or other locations where that information is made available to the public. We have assisted state agencies, local units of government, and schools with energy efficiency financing tools. One of the first executive orders that that Governor Dayton signed in 2011 was to create a guaranteed energy savings program. And through this program, state agencies are required to achieve a 20% reduction in their energy use. These are buildings that the state of Minnesota actually owns, not the buildings that are leased by the state. We are working with a group of energy services companies to provide the guaranteed financing for those programs. Basically, it's financing that allows major capital improvements to be made to buildings and paid for through the energy savings that are generated by the projects themselves. We also assure energy emergency preparedness in the event of some sort of a disaster or supply shortage. We monitor supplies of fuel and other forms of energy entering and leaving the state to assure that Minnesota has adequate supplies of energy on a going forward basis. And we have rules in place permit us to implement emergency conservation procedures and other procedures in the event that we should be faced with some sort of a crisis. I want to introduce some of the people that work in the department, my management team, we have a fair number of them here actually this afternoon. And in no particular order, I'll introduce the managers first and then some of the supervisors that are also here. Are managing the energy planning and advocacy staff, Kate O'Connell, and maybe Kate, you can just wave to the nice people. It's Kate's group that is the group that appears regularly before the Public Utilities Commission. These are economists, for the most part, that evaluate utility rate filings to make sure that consumers are getting the best deal possible. Managing our State Energy Programs Office, Janet Streff. And it's the range of activities within Janet's group are almost too numerous to mention, but they include the Conservation Improvement Program, and Jessica Burdett is here, and she manages that program for us. The Weatherization Assistance Program, Mary Lou Chappell, I believe is here, yes, Mary Lou. And our deployment unit, which helps consumers identify renewable and other energy conservation opportunities. Michelle Grancy Bowman is the supervisor of that unit. And Michelle is here. Our energy assistance program is ably run by John Harvenko. And our energy facility permitting shop is run by Deb Pyle. Some of the strategies that we pursue in accomplishing all of the objectives that I've outlined. First, we really want to assure that Minnesota's energy system supports a strong economy, job creation, and a healthy environment. And if you think about it, these are really the things that we want out of our energy system. We want affordable costs. We want to be able to make sure that we have sufficient and ample energy to run the economy. And hopefully, if we do both of those things right, we're also going to create jobs in the process. We want to ensure sufficient, reliable energy at reasonable costs. We want to improve our existing energy infrastructure while protecting ratepayers. And one of the things that we're seeing now, and Mr. Eliff made reference to this, is that like everything else that we as a society have built, our energy infrastructure is aging, and there are significant costs to maintain and upgrade those systems. transmission lines are just one example. We went through a period in the 70s and 80s where we made very little investment in our transmission infrastructure, and some of those costs are now coming due, both just to maintain the system that we have and to upgrade it to meet modern demands. We want to advance state leadership in energy efficiency. Minnesota consistently ranks in the top 10 states in the country for the energy efficiency programs that we operate here in partnership with our utilities, and we want to make sure that we maintain and advance that lead as much as possible. We want to expand the state's renewable energy potential and energy business activity. When you think about it, Minnesota is a state without natural resources in the energy area, except for those renewable sources that we do have in abundance here: wind, solar, biomass, hydroelectricity. And so it's important that we take advantage of the competitive advantage that we do have with those resources, while realizing that we send billions of dollars out of state every year to purchase fossil energy from other states and countries. And finally, we want to continue to assist low-income Minnesotans through financial assistance and energy conservation measures, and we see this as a critical part of the overall energy picture that that is so important to low-income and vulnerable Minnesotans. So I want to give you just some sense in a few quick diagrams of where Minnesota is from an energy perspective. This is a pie chart showing where our energy use occurs and in what sectors. And you can see that we're reasonably evenly divided amongst four basic sectors: residential, commercial, industrial, and transportation. And I would say that the department and the Public Utilities Commission, in terms of the energy use that we oversee, is largely in the residential, commercial, and industrial areas. Transportation fuels are largely unregulated, and we monitor transportation fuel supplies, but don't play a regulatory role other than that. Going down to electricity sources, you can see the breakout here of our energy sources by fuel type. And I thought it was interesting to put these two slides next to each other because there's a tendency to think that things never change, but things actually have changed rather dramatically over the last 10 years for many of the reasons that Mr. Eliff outlined a few minutes ago. Some of the biggest changes you can see here are with respect to the proportionate shares of coal, natural gas, and the various renewable energy sources. Natural gas and renewables have grown largely at the expense of the share of coal-fired electricity serving the state of Minnesota. The nuclear component has stayed almost exactly the same, but these others are much more fluid, and I believe the trends that we see from 2000 to 2010 are likely to continue as Minnesota completes its work on the renewable energy standard and as natural gas continues to be a low-cost and abundant alternative for electricity generation. Just looking at where we are with respect to the renewable energy standard, this graph shows you a couple of things. One, that we really have two standards in Minnesota. We have one for Xcel Energy and one for everyone else. And Xcel's standard is to achieve 25% by 2020, or rather 30% by 2020, and everyone else's is to achieve 25% by the year 2025. Another thing that you can see from this graph is that there are, we don't have them outlined here, but were a series of interim targets in the statute. And I'll just tell you, because the graph doesn't really show this, but we are either on track or ahead of schedule across the board with all utilities in meeting the renewable energy standard at this point. The biggest impediment, I would say, to successful completion of the renewable energy standard is going to be the availability of transmission. If you think about it, the wind, which has been by far and away the largest renewable source meeting the renewable energy standard to date, the wind tends to blow in areas of the state where people don't generally live in large numbers. So the wind needs to get from the windy areas to the load centers, and the way that happens is over high voltage transmission lines. So we've been very active in working with utilities and other stakeholders to make sure that the pace at which we're building out the needed components of the transmission system, which by the way are helpful not only for renewable energy development but for the overall reliability of the grid, to make sure that we stay on pace to have sufficient capacity to deliver that wind and other renewable energy sources to the load. The other kind of big meta development in this area, though, I would say, is the growing interest on the part of consumers to generate their own electricity. We refer to this as distributed generation, and more customers are realizing that they may have that it may be in their economic interests, but maybe also for their own personal reasons, have decided that they want to contribute a significant amount of generation to their own needs. And I believe that as we move forward, this will be an important area of policy for this committee and future legislatures to address. It's not likely to be the big driver in meeting a renewable energy standard, at least in the near term, but it does represent, I think, a significant shift in consumers' attitude toward their own electricity, their own energy needs. This chart brings in all of the other renewable energy sources that fuel Minnesota's economy, and you can see that, thank you, a fair amount of ethanol and other liquid fuels for transportation purposes primarily are also produced here in Minnesota, but by and large the renewable sources that we're seeing are contributing to our electricity supply. And I think this is my last slide, Madam Chair, on energy efficiency. I mentioned before the goal of the state of Minnesota to achieve 1.5% energy savings from our utilities on an annual basis. and I should clarify that for natural gas utilities, that's a little bit lower. And you can see where we are relative to the goals. It took a little while, but we're now achieving the goal on the electricity side and very close to achieving the goal on the natural gas side. One of the big policy questions, though, is how sustainable is that level of efficiency over a longer period of time? And there are some who are concerned that we've kind of plucked all the low-hanging fruit on the efficiency side and that we won't be able to sustain these kinds of efficiency levels over time. I'll tell you that just for context, people have been saying that for a long time, and we've managed to achieve these goals consistently over that same period of time. But the future is always a little cloudier than the past, and I would say that new technologies are likely to keep us on pace with being able to achieve these goals, at least in the near to medium term. The longer term is obviously more difficult, and much of the conservation that we do see in our economy is price-driven, and as the cost of energy either rises or falls, customers' interests in pursuing conservation rise and fall with it. And so as we've seen natural gas prices fall dramatically, we're concerned that keeping pace on the natural gas side with efficiency is going to become more difficult, whereas we really have the opposite situation on the electricity side. we are going to continue to see costs go up. For one thing, to maintain the system in its current and future forms, and it's for that reason that I would expect on the electricity side that we're going to continue to be able to achieve or exceed these goals. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
I have just two quick ones, and then I'll go to members' questions. You said that one of the things that the Department of Commerce does is it helps new energy technologies get going.
Right.
Do you have a specific example that would help illustrate that?
Sure, Madam Chair.
If you don't, off the top of your head, you could shoot us an email.
I'd be happy to shoot the committee an email. There are actually too many to mention, but I want to make sure that I give you one that's kind of representative of those efforts.
Because I did a lot of research trying to become ready to be energy chair, and I missed that topic of your work. The other thing is, with distributed generation, do the utilities get credit for that renewable energy? Say, Representative Quam and I invested in a solar project in Rochester, and the utility purchased that power. Would they get to apply that towards their renewable energy goal?
Madam Chair, in a word, yes. They are able to count that energy toward their goal.
All right, then Representative Quam had some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Grant, for the presentation. A little more detail, and I numbered the slides. Slide 6, the energy consumption. I don't see agriculture. You have a commercial, industrial, and agriculture being such a large portion. Do you have a similar pie that you could give us with agriculture?
Madam Chair, it'd certainly be possible to break that out. Of course, it's embedded in all of these sources here. They account for a fair amount of the transportation energy sources, for example, and most farms are treated as commercial sector properties, so those numbers are embedded in these numbers, but I can certainly try to break that out for you just so you can look at what the agricultural sector itself would look like.
Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grant, on slide 7, looking at that, I was curious as how much of the hydro is the Canadian hydro versus the small facilities we have, and that's still Minnesota Water generating that that hydro.
Right. The hydro that we import from Canada will be in the import column, not in the hydroelectric would be the state share of hydroelectric. So those dams that are operating here in the state.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I noticed the natural gas, realizing that North Dakota, with their burn off of natural gas, we do receive that in the atmosphere, and we're downwind of that. Has there been any discussion, especially with many of these munis, with the old coal shutting down or converting, of having a pipeline so that we'd have the additional supply of natural gas and prevent that burn-off and environmental impact and be able to upgrade and have those locally placed plants?
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, most of the natural gas that Minnesota receives by pipeline is either from the Gulf Coast or from Canada. And at present, we don't have pipeline access directly to the gas that's being flared, for the most part, in North Dakota. And it's my understanding that the objective of most of the Bakken plays in North Dakota are to recover oil and not natural gas. I think there has been some discussion about the construction of a natural gas pipeline once those fields are more fully up and producing. Where that pipeline would go is a matter for the industry to determine. That's not something that state of Minnesota or other states can regulate.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grant, as touched by Mr. Eloff, And on in conjunction with slide 8, I know there's that report that's coming out on the generation cost or rate by the different programs for renewable. Do you have a chart that has the rate impact graphed similar to what you have on slide 8 with the Excel and the other utilities?
Mr. Grant. Madam Chair and Representative Quam, I do not. However, we have reviewed now one report from the utilities describing the rate impacts associated with the renewable energy standard. And with a couple of small exceptions, what we found is that the cost was at or below what the cost would have been to acquire other resources. In other words, had there not been a renewable energy standard, and the only way that we were acquiring resources is as we usually do through an integrated resource planning process, we would have acquired roughly the same amount of renewable wind as we did without the renewable energy standard in place.
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, thank you. And this would tie up the last of my question on the slides. Mr. Grant, on slide 9, you've got the different types, and that generation. You mentioned that this is a mix of fuel and electric.
Mm-hmm.
When you work out these percentages, say you do not, is this based off of capacity or actual generated load? Because if you have a windy year or, not as sunny and there's, less solar, less wind, how do you calculate these percentages for those that are not baseline?
Mr.
Right,
Grant.
And Madam Chair, Representative Quam, since this is sources of energy consumption by BTU, it's my understanding that what we've done here is first to track how much energy was actually produced, not the nameplate capacity, but the actual amount of energy produced, and then converted that all to a standard British thermal unit measurement so that they could be compared with each other. So this is actual consumption.
Representative Grafflo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions. Number one, actually, just before I get into my questions, can you just elaborate on the nameplate capacity issue versus actual production? Explain
sure.
It to members of the committee.
Sure. Usually when we talk about electricity, we talk about either the capacity, in other words, the instantaneous amount of energy that a plant could produce, and then the energy production, which is usually something less than that. The nameplate capacity, let's say for a natural gas turbine, will be, let's say it's 100 megawatts, but because it's generating maybe only half the time, the actual energy output, the capacity factor of that plant is maybe 50%. So that's the difference between capacity and energy. And certainly true of renewable sources, since they don't produce except when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining, generally the capacity factors on those systems are substantially lower. In the case of wind, it's usually in the 20 to 25% range, and a little better than that for solar.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Grant, members of the committee should keep an eye on that, because I'm imagining some people will interchange those numbers without explaining to members of the committee if it possibly benefits or discourages certain policy changes. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's...
You don't need to answer that.
Certainly are.
And then, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, we see from 2000 to 2010 a more than tripling of natural gas usage. Since 2010, obviously, natural gas pricing has continued to go down even lower. One would assume that the natural gas, the percentage of our portfolio using natural gas has increased even more. Is that are those both correct statements?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Representative Grafflo, I believe that is a true statement and will continue to be a trend that we're seeing. It's not only true here in Minnesota, but true nationally as well.
Representative Grafflo.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Grant, so then obviously there should be, there's some significant cost savings as a result of this with natural gas at lower prices. Is it fair to say that one of the things that's happening with the result of lower natural gas costs being a greater percentage of the portfolio is that we're using this to to cover the additional capital costs that are taking place right now, and maybe some of those maintenance issues you referred to that The savings, the reason why people aren't seeing lower rates, even though we're using a more affordable energy source, is because we're using it to kind of catch up on those investments that haven't taken place.
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think that that's generally a true statement. Natural gas is a good hedge in the market against the volatility of other fuels and resources, but all forms of energy have a certain amount of volatility. Of course, the renewable sources have no fuel price volatility. Natural gas, even though I think people are somewhat optimistically saying that natural gas prices are going to remain low for a long period of time, are forgetting the fact that natural gas has been a fairly volatilely priced fuel over time, and that as we put more demand pressure on it, the market is likely to react in the same way it always does when there's more demand pressure. But I think that your statement is generally correct in terms of a snapshot of where we are right now.
Sure. And Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Mr. Grant, absolutely. And obviously one of the trade-offs with energy, any energy source, is that natural gas, in addition to being used to create electricity, is also used for heat. There's a question of whether we want to put all our eggs in one basket, and that is understood. My other question is that, so with regards to the fact that these lower natural gas prices are helping us, and I don't mean to use the word mask, but I guess that's what's happening, right? We're seeing lower costs in one area of our energy portfolio. We're seeing higher costs in the area of capital. Is there is it also masking the higher costs of some of these new non-traditional sources?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, that would take a more detailed analysis than I have done. One thing to remember is that even though we've seen lower natural gas prices, we've also had to build peaking and combined cycle power plants to actually utilize the gas. And so in the near term, I'm not sure that we've really realized the savings that maybe in the out years we will be able to as those generating resources are sunk costs in the system.
And Representative Greffel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Grant, so but it is fair to say that, you know, when customers just see higher utility bills, mm-hmm. that's all they see. They see that they're paying more for energy. Within that higher number and higher cost to ratepayers, there are items that are lowering in cost. There's items that are increasing in cost. And for new members of the committee who are interested in seeing a more granular aspect of those things, what resources would you recommend for members to know? What items are cost drivers going up? What items are going down?
Madam Chair and Representative, and I don't have this information across all utilities. You're probably aware that Xcel Energy has announced a rate increase request recently, and they point to two big drivers on their system. One is the cost of new transmission that they're investing quite heavily in, as I mentioned before, and the other is maintenance of their nuclear facilities, particularly to comply with federal standards post the Fukushima disaster. And those are the big drivers that they're seeing. So it's really maintenance of the system and upgrades to existing facilities more than it has been the addition of new facilities, be they renewable or otherwise. One of the things that I would say has been has helped keep energy prices generally in check has been the energy conservation measures that utilities have invested in. They are, for the most part, generally well below the average costs of existing or new generation to acquire those efficiency resources.
And Madam Chair,
I don't know if Commissioner Rothman wanted to add to that to some feedback to your last question.
I just have some numbers that. I mean, these are some numbers that the department works on and we're quite proud of in terms of the amount of work that the staff does, and goes to the point about cost savings to Minnesotans. $130 million is saved for Minnesota ratepayers in 2012 alone due to the recommendations the department made in terms of bringing down ultimately the rates. These go to the rate cases that are at the PUC. We also have 980,000 megawatts of electricity saved through the SIP program that Bill was describing before, and as well 2.8 million in MCF of natural gas use. So the conservation, the costs are being brought down, and then the programs that we have help reduce demand at the same time. So some good numbers.
And, thank you, Commissioner Rothman. Representative Grafflo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Grant. So certainly the the SIP program has been able to give us the opportunity to not generate new power, but I think it's fair to point out that nationwide, one of the reasons why there hasn't need to be additional energy generation is because the economy has sucked. I mean, that's a big part, but that's an important point to point out. But I would just I have lots of newfound free time now as opposed to the previous session, and I have a genuine interest in reading about this. If there are if the data that can be made available to this committee in terms of what are specific cost drivers, and obviously there's going to be statewide aggregate numbers, and there's going to be individual utilities that are affected in different fashions. To the degree that we can get that information and just provide some nice bedtime reading for the members of the committee, I think it would be a very helpful piece of information, and I thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to provide that.
Representative Beard, did Representative Garofalo ask your questions?
Madam Chair, actually, yes, he did. And it's, as you know, six terms. I eat this stuff up, but I'm looking at eyes glazing over around the rest of the room and recognizing that maybe not all of us have the level of interest that I do. But I was just going to point out in the cost of renewable energy standard, the 2010 legislature actually required a report for this legislature, which was released, I think, in 2011 or early 2012, which is great reading, and it shows the fact that one size does not fit all. That indeed the municipal power companies and the co-ops that are largely not in the generation business see a different impact on their rates than the investor-owned utilities have seen. Perhaps we could get that distributed as in that bedtime reading material Representative Garofalo was just referring to. That would be a good report for us to go through and maybe a suggestion for committee hearing one of these days.
Mr. Grant, is that something you could email a link to us?
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair, we could.
Did you have any other questions, Representative Beard? No?
He can save the sparks on me. I have the actual paper copy in my
okay.
office.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Grant, and thanks for all of your great work. Two questions I hope will be relatively quick, Madam Chair. One is I was struck on the slide on renewable energy. I don't know which number it was. I wasn't tracking it like Representative Klum was. But
was this the one you're...
No, sources of renewable energy consumption in Minnesota 2010 by BTU.
Oh.
And I was struck by how that if you look at solar and geothermal combined, it was 1%, and wood and waste was 48.1. Could you break down that wood and waste section of the pie? How much is that municipal waste? Is it methane from landfills? Is it... some sort of cellulosic ethanol burning. If you could break down that for a little bit more for
us, Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. One of the larger slices of that slice of the pie will be waste energy projects, the combustion of garbage to generate electricity. Remember that a fair number of Minnesotans use wood to heat their homes, either primarily or as a supplement, and so we'd be seeing a fair amount of heating-related uses on the wood side. There are some wood-fired biomass facilities to generate electricity, but I'd have to get into the numbers to be able to really answer your question in more
okay.
detail.
Okay, thank you. It'd be good to get that. And the last question I have would be, again, we talked about the reason for the rate increase. It's reminded me of, some of my concerns about Prairie Island and the waste storage there. Are you hearing anything from the federal government about permanent waste? We don't have Yucca Mountain. Do you have a time horizon as to how long we can expect that waste will be stored at Prairie Island?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein, as you may know, the current administration decided early in its tenure to stop characterization activities at the Yucca Mountain site. They have since formed a Blue Ribbon Commission looking at waste storage alternatives, and I believe they've recently released their recommendations, which, as I understand it, is for a series of interim disposal sites in locations around the country, with at least the recommendation is that these facilities would be up and begin receiving waste as early as 2020. Now, there are going to be some interesting questions, since it's unlikely that enough storage capacity can be built to store all of the nuclear waste that's currently being stored at individual generating stations around the country, like at Prairie Island and at Monticello. And depending on where a particular utility is in the waste storage queue, whether or not they're going to be able to begin shipping some or all of their stored waste to these facilities, assuming that they become operational. But that seems to be the general plan, is that there be a series of interim sites constructed in the fairly near term to begin receiving that waste.
Representative Hornstein.
Madam Chair, yeah. So I just would hope that our committee can take a look at this. You know, I know this has been in the news. The city of Red Wing has had some ideas and proposals. The tribe is involved. I think it'd be a, you know, maybe a day we could spend or part of a session on just nuclear waste-related issues. I think it's pretty huge, and it seems as if we're going to be looking at this for a long time in our state, that it doesn't appear that it's going anywhere soon. So I hope we can have some more conversation about that.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Any closing comments that you wanted to make, Mr. Grant?
No, Madam Chair. I'm hoping that members of my staff have been taking notes about some of the information requests that you've made, so that we can respond to those to you in a quick time.
Representative Falk has a question, but what I did want to also mention before we adjourn, before all the rest of the lobbyists leave as we finish our questions, because it's information for the members as well as the folks who are monitoring what's happening in this committee, I just want to give you a sense of how I intend to run things when we do start to have bills. I don't foresee that this is a committee where we're going to be hearing big, complicated bills and then voting on them the same day. If I intend to have us vote on a bill, I'll let you know that before the committee hearing. But I think it's important for members to come with an open mind and to ask questions and to have both sides give their best argument, and then to have some time to think it over, because this is a complex area. It deals with natural resources. It deals with people's pocketbooks, the balance between business and residential. And so I think that the approach I'm going to try to take, and we'll see how it works as session goes on, but is that we would look before we leap. So normally lobbyists are in the practice of getting their votes counted before the bill even shows up at committee, and members are having to make a commitment before they've heard a bill. And in this committee, it's my intention that we won't have to make those kind of commitments until we've at least heard the evidence on both sides. And that's different from how most committees I've been in are run. So I wanted to mention that before we kind of get rolling. And with that, Representative Falk, your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I had two things hopefully Commissioner Grant could maybe comment on or speak to a little bit. The first that actually perked my interest was he made the comment with this interim waste storage facilities that have been proposed, just kind of looking at past precedent where we had temporary storage in the state that was permitted as temporary storage, which has really become more long-term storage. I don't want to use the term permanent because I hope that's not the road we go down, but do you have any context or clarification to what the definition of interim temporary storage would be?
Mr. Grant.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Falk, as I mentioned, I think that goes to this question of where a utility is in the larger national queue for who gets to send waste to an interim or final repository to begin with. And to the extent that you're toward the end back of the list, chances are you would have to consider your storage facility more on the permanent side rather than on the temporary side. So I think it's a timing question, really, and also a capacity question, just how much capacity will these facilities have. There will be a lot of debate about how the waste is transported to those facilities, and some routes will be more controversial than others. And so where we are in proximity to not only the closest but the least controversial routes to remove that waste, I think will have a bearing on how much of that waste stays here versus goes somewhere else.
Representative Falk, a last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a separate topic was we had a number of comments and questions about just what the cost drivers are, and I think maybe this is something more for the Public Utilities Commission, but one of the things that wasn't touched on is some of the fuel surcharge adjustment clauses that we have in place. And so it's maybe not so much the assets themselves and the rates of return on the assets, but differences in cost of procuring the fuel source, delivering that to the place where it's combusted or used to essentially generate the energy. And I don't know if that was touched on or broken out this in any of these cost descriptions.
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Representative Falk, no, I didn't attempt to break those out. And those are going to be different utility by utility depending on the mix of resources that they have generating electricity. In the natural gas case, most of the costs that you pay are the fuel costs itself, and a relatively smaller amount are the distribution costs. But we can certainly get that information for you.
Members, just a reminder, if you would like to save your notes from today or the handouts, please put them in the folder marked Save. We'll recycle everything that's not in the Save folder. Tomorrow, our hearing for our committee is in room 5. You might have noticed on the schedule we changed rooms. On Mondays, we're in this room, and on Tuesdays, we're in room 5. And tomorrow, we will be with our Senate counterparts, and we will be hearing from the Public Utilities Commission. So with that, members, we're adjourned.